Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Task 90 call today. We appreciate you joining us. This is Tracy Morton, and I'm joined here with Terry Hill, Cami Norland, Nicole Clement, and Kate Stenyum from Task. So we appreciate you joining us here today. Our format for the Task 90 series for this program year is a little bit different. We found that the webinars seemed to be successful and helpful to the participants last year with having slide sets available. And so all of our Task 90 calls this year won't actually just be conference calls, but they'll be in a webinar format as well. And we're interested in your feedback on that. Just like last year, as we go forward with the calls, after a call is done, we'll be sending out an evaluation to you for your feedback on the contents of the call or the webinar, I'm sorry, as well as the quality of it. And so we're interested in any feedback that you have to offer.
And even though we're having a webinar, we still want to encourage as much discussion as possible as well. And so I think most of the folks know each other, et cetera. So hopefully this will be a comfortable format to discuss issues, ask questions, et cetera. But I think this, with the addition of the WebEx itself, we think it's going to add additional value.
And then just to cover our agenda for today, Terry and I will provide a brief update from TASC. Quite a fleet of people are on the phone from ORHP to provide an update. Mike McNeely, Megan Meacham, Aaron Fishbach, and Nicole Como are going to be on to talk about updates and happenings within the Office of Rural Health Policy, as well as with the Medicare Beneficiary Quality Improvement Project, and to provide a critical access hospital regulatory update. Then John Gale from the University of Southern Maine, part of the Flex Monitoring Team, is going to provide an update from their perspective. And then the topical content of today's webinar is on ICD-10s and version 5010 updates. So Brooke Pelkey with the College of St. Scholastica will be providing an overview on ICD-10, and then David Ginsberg with Private Plan Associates will be providing an update on the HIPAA version 5010s. And during that part, we definitely encourage your discussion and questions, and I'll introduce the speakers further when we get to that. I guess to move forward with a couple updates then from TASC, our coalition, the National Rural HIT Coalition, met recently, and one of the important updates within the coalition is over the last few months they've been working collectively with some of the leaders within the coalition and with the support of the National Rural Health Association to provide comments to CMS on critical access hospital incentive payment issues and to clarify some of the issues. So those comments have now been moved along to CMS, and we're anxiously awaiting their clarification on many things that impact the CHs are reimbursed for the technologies that they're purchasing.
Kind of on that topic as well, as most of you are aware, the National Rural Health Association in 2010 did a survey of critical access hospitals about HIT capacity and kind of their expectations as to how long it would take them, et cetera. We're going to be, through NRHA, we're going to be launching another survey. We're going to be helping with it, and we would ask for your help as well. And that is, we're trying to examine the relationship between electronic health records and quality improvement. So a woman by the name of Arshia Khan is going to do her PhD thesis on this topic, and she's been working with Box Labov of the National Rural Health Association and with us and designing a survey, relatively short, that would go out to the critical access hospitals to try to, again, get some of that information. So we almost apologize in advance. I know these hospitals have been surveyed to death, but it's really, I think, important to be able to quantify quality improvement, to gather evidence about, particularly from a critical access hospital standpoint, about, you know, what is the impact of putting electronic health records in. And again, as we've learned over the years, having the hospitals talk about this themselves is always more persuasive than having a bunch of experts up there. So I just want to let you know that that's going to be coming shortly, and anything that you could do to help encourage that response. Again, we promise we'll be judicious about any, and again, it's coming out of the National Rural Health Association, but we did think this was kind of an important topic area. It's a relatively short survey. Wouldn't take more than a couple of minutes to do, and just let you know that it'll be coming out relatively shortly.
I think other work within TASC to note regarding health information technology is TASC has received a supplement through the Office of Rural Health Policy to work collectively with the University of Southern Maine in supporting the rollout of a survey to rural health clinics to ascertain their level of adoption and use of health information technology. TASC's role is to expand our database to aggregate information about all of the rural health clinics nationally. There are 3,800 of them. And to identify really where they are, where they're located, and how best to get in touch with them as that collective information isn't well maintained right now. And then to support the university in rolling out the survey. And we'll be reaching out to our national partners and organizations, and specifically to the FLEX programs and the state offices of rural health for your support in reaching out to the rural health clinics that you have contact with to get their information that we can best then survey, and then also to help promote them in their response to completing the survey.
And the problem basically is we don't have any good information about the value that rural health clinics bring. We do not have a complete database, so we're able to even survey the rural health clinics. So we would really appreciate any support that you could give us in terms of helping us kind of gather information on the rural health clinics within your state. We do understand, we're not going into this blindly, we understand how difficult it's going to be, but basically I think we've all pretty much come to the conclusion that as hard as it's going to be, we're really going to need to have information or else rural health clinics could be put upon the chopping block and they're going to have very, very little evidence to show their value simply because nobody's ever really surveyed them in totality. So, again, we always rely on your help and would appreciate anything that you could do to help us get this information. And in support of the monitoring team, University of Southern Maine, and that also will you'll see coming out before. We'll be approaching you before Christmas and get that survey into the field. So, new survey coming out on the relationship between quality and critical access, hospital HIT, and another survey, an extremely important one. This one, you know, it's the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, the monitoring team, ourselves. Very importantly, we need to develop a better national database on rural health clinics and also to figure out kind of where they are on the road to meaningful use.
And then regarding supplements, and a last update from TASC is that we did receive additional supplements from the Office of Rural Health Policy to support the MIBQIP project. One will be to help identify information and best approaches to working on the 24/7 pharmacist review of medical orders in order to prevent medication errors. And the second activity, which we'll also be working on shortly and sending out information, is regarding HCAHPS, and that would be to identify benefits and barriers for HCAHPS implementation in critical access hospitals, and collectively identifying all the HCAHPS vendors and finding out their experience with rural, what services they're offering, and creating a directory. And so Cami Norland from our staff is leading that initiative, and you will be hearing shortly from us as we move forward with that project too.
Right. So in essence, if your hospitals are asking who's out there from an HCAHPS standpoint, what does it cost, you know, who are the contact people, we will have that information for you as completely as possible. And there are, from what we understand, there are at least 40 or 50 vendors and probably more by now. So again, the intent here is to have a apples-to-apples comparison to the degree we can do that and to be able to direct hospitals and to information so that they can make an informed choice. Another quick thing, too, and it's not really about TASC, although TASC is certainly the model, but our National Rural Health Resource Center has just received a contract from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy to be the technical assistance and kind of knowledge support center for the 40 new rural HIT network grants. And one of the first things we're going to be telling those networks is you really should work closely with your state FLEX program, state offices of rural health, associations, et cetera. So if you have any questions about whether you have them in your state or contact information, et cetera, we are going to be, again, acquiring both information on what they're doing and kind of, again, creating a knowledge center and HIT networks, and then providing a whole kind of array of services, very much like TASC does. So we're using the TASC model. We have 40 compared to 45 state flex programs. We think that this works, and again, we just encourage you to contact us if there's anything we can do, because it's going to be extremely important that all 40 of those networks work with our state flex programs.
Great, and with that, I think that we'll move into updates from Mike McNeely and Megan Meacham at ORHP. So it is star pound then to unmute your line.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well. Just a few updates in relation to Flex and ORHP in general. First thing, we wanted to make sure everyone's heard about our push about partnership for patients over the last few months. We can say about a quarter of all critical access hospitals have pledged, and there are a number of SOARs that have also pledged. But with National Rural Health Day coming up on the 17th, coming up next Thursday, HRSA is putting on a webinar on partnership for patients, and we're looking to highlight patient safety and care transition initiatives. So if you have any initiatives that you would like to highlight, please contact Christy Martinson in relation to it, and we'll get into that. Additionally, next Friday on October the 18th, the Office of National Coordinator is having their national grantee meeting, and of particular interest to the SOAR and FLEX, there is a session from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern, which is basically about the FCC Rural Healthcare Program and how SOAR grantees can interact with it. There's registration info that was sent out to on the weekly updates. When you sign up for it, you will be waitlisted, but it will be a streaming event. So there will be more information coming out in the near future relating to that. Another call that's occurring will be this coming Monday at 1 o'clock. There is a call going over the MOU with USDA. Basically, it will be a representation of how the MOU and the role of SOARs and how SOARs will be affected by it. It will highlight the Community Facilities Fund and the distance learning and telehealth fund. But this information was also sent out by Christy recently, so just to give you a heads up and a reminder that these are coming up. In regards to FLEX itself, the actual program measures have been coming along pretty nicely now. We've been vetting them through various sources, and we've identified a small group of FLEX coordinators that we are going to bounce off the latest version so that we can get additional input. We want to make sure that it was a manageable amount of input for this. We tried to be even with the distribution of the regionalization of personnel. And once we have that call, which will be coming up in the next week, we are going to put things together, do a final review, ideally right after Thanksgiving with an internal review source. And then our target goal for the release of new measures will be at the end of the month, early December. So be on the lookout for that. With that in mind, some of you received a timeline of the release of the grant guidances, or the expected release dates. The reasoning for the clustering of those timelines was that we intend for you, once you receive these FLEX measures, to start developing your work plan over the next 4 months. The actual release date for the guidance is targeted for about March 15th of 2012, so we want you to be working towards that so that when the actual guidance comes out, you're almost finished with what you need to do versus just starting at that point. So keep that in mind when once this is released. It's not something that we encourage you to sit on. We want you to be actively thinking about how you're going to implement the measures that are being proposed. Also a reminder, this is just a beta test in effect. This is something that we're working towards the competitive guidance. So as we figure out what works and what doesn't work, we will definitely change things if they're not working. On that note, I will give the floor to Megan.
All right. Hi, everyone. I am going to just give a really brief MBQIP update. First of all, I hope you all received our inaugural MBQIP monthly email that Mike sent out late last week, I believe. It's something that we wanted to put together just to keep everyone on the same page with MBQIP. In the future, we're really hoping to highlight any success stories that you guys have going on in your state, so definitely get those to me. We really want to make this just as much about you and what you're doing as it is about letting you know also what we're doing. So on behalf of OHP, I would like to thank each and every one of you. We have, as of about noon today, we have 850 MOUs in-house. That's 64% of our CAHs nationwide. So that's great. Absolutely wonderful. Eight of those states are actually at 100%, so congratulations. And we have 42 of 45 flex states participating. So again, just as of when we first started September 1, we were only at 34 states. So just in this short amount of time, you guys have really stepped up, and we're getting MOUs are rolling in every day. We're getting a few more, so just keep it up. We couldn't do it without you guys. So that being said, there's always more work to do. So right now, we kind of see the flex coordinator role with MBQIP being twofold. First of all, you have your hospitals that are signed up for MBQIP, and a large portion of those are already also reporting to Hospital Compare, but you're going to want to make sure that you're providing assistance to those hospitals that may not already be reporting to Hospital Compare. Find out what they need so that at the end of the first quarter, this October 1 to December 31st, period. The reporting deadline is May 15th, so you just want to make sure that they're ready to get their data in. And then on the other side of that, we have about 300 hospitals that are reporting to Hospital Compare, but they're not signed up for MBQIP. So that should be a pretty easy sell since they're already doing the work, they're already reporting. If you need any assistance or have any questions on, you know, how to get those hospitals on board, feel free to contact me, Mike, your project officer, anyone in OHP. We're here for you guys to help you with this. And then just, you know, as Tracy and Terry mentioned, we're starting to work on phase two and phase three so that we're ready to go when FY 12 and 13 roll around. And then also the other thing, it was highlighted in the monthly as well, just we're going to be putting together an MBQIP email distribution list, so just watch for an email from Mike regarding that. And just thanks for everything, and keep it up.
Well, thank you very much, Megan and Mike. Does anyone have any questions for them? Again, it's star pound to mute or unmute your line.
This is Sarah Roberts from the Kansas office. One of the questions that have come up with a few of our MBQIP participants is how, when the measures for pneumonia are changing, and I believe there's some measures for heart failure that's changing on what is core from CMS, how will MBQIP change, or will MBQIP change with those measures? Does that make sense? So will we stick with having those seven core measures that we originally told them to report on, or will we, MBQIP, be just using what CMS changes the core measures to?
Hi, Sarah. I think your hospitals have been flies on the wall in our office because we've been having this conversation in-house as well. And Christy, if you want to pipe in at all as well, feel free. Right now, I can tell you we're having these conversations. We know that CMS does occasionally retire measures, and you know, as luck would have it, it would be some of the measures we decided to use. And so, you know, MBQIP will probably have to, you know, we'll have to be flexible and we'll have to go with CMS. But as soon as we have a firm decision on that, we'll let everyone know what the direction will be.
Yeah, Megan, this is Christy. We don't, because we're capturing the data through Hospital Compare, we're going to have to use whatever Hospital Compare has. So CMS is retiring these measures because a lot of the hospitals, or all the PPS hospitals, have been reporting on them for a while, and they're at the levels that they need to be in terms of their outcomes. And so that's one of the reasons that they're retiring. So unfortunately, for critical access hospitals who haven't been reporting as long and haven't had that time to get up to the benchmark levels, we're not going to be able to track those anymore through Hospital Compare.
Will MBQIP be looking at, then, from the standpoint that if these are still important measures for the critical access hospitals to be reporting, will we be looking at other ways to collect that? Or will the decision be either we go with what's on CMS or we don't?
We're going to stick with what CMS has. So what Megan alluded to is just if there's other ways that hospitals are interested in tracking it themselves, how to incorporate that in. But for the official MBQIP, we're sticking with what Hospital Compare has. So if anyone else has thoughts on that, please email Megan or myself or Paul, and we're going to continue to have these conversations. But as with when we started out with MBQIP, the goal is to not duplicate any efforts or create new systems. So with that, we're sticking with where Hospital Compare goes.
Well, thank you, Christy, Mike, and Megan. And I think now we'll move into a short presentation from Aaron Fishman and Nicole Como with ORHP about policy updates and CH regulatory changes.
Probably very short. First of all, can you hear me or do I need to get closer to the speakerphone?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks, Aaron.
Okay. First, Michelle Goodman extends her apologies for not being able to participate. So I'm covering her topic, so I'm not as versed, so forgive me, and we'll buzz through them pretty quickly. If you have any questions, feel free to email her later, or we can try to answer them. So, on October 18th, CMS issued two proposed regulations as part of the White House's effort to reduce regulatory burden and improve transparency. And the first one was looking at some hospital and critical access hospital conditions of participation. And one aspect of it is to allow critical access hospitals to provide a variety of services under contract or arrangement rather than having to directly provide them. So rather than necessarily employing staff directly, they can contract for some of those services. They also had some other changes, including eliminating a requirement for a single director of outpatient services. If there's a health system that has multiple hospitals, they can have one governing body instead of having one for each hospital. And then they also can have a single interdisciplinary care plan instead of having a separate standalone nursing care plan. The second regulation included some provisions to promote efficiency, transparency, and reduce burdens. And a couple of the provisions we wanted to highlight was removing the automatic deactivation of folks who don't file claims for 12 consecutive months. This particularly impacted RHCs and FQHCs because they bill under the clinic's national provider identifier number. And so if they didn't have any individual claims, their enrollment in PCOS could expire. And if your enrollment expires, then you have a problem providing referrals, that those referrals would not, any claims resulting as a result of a referral would not be paid. And so therefore specialists would not accept referrals from those providers. So they were going to have to go in and enroll and enroll every 12 months. And so CMS decided to forego that, which was originally a program integrity idea. The second thing is updating some e-prescribing technical requirements. And then we provide a link to the proposed rule, so if you need some late night reading, you can do that. Another rule, the final rule on the 2012 hospital outpatient prospective payment system. They wanted to note that on supervision issues, they continue to extend the non-enforcement for critical access hospitals and other small rural hospitals through 2012. They've established an independent advisory review process that's going to go through the ambulatory payment classification panel. And for these purposes, they are going to add two small rural PPS hospitals and two critical access hospital members to the board to take into consideration these supervision issues. Physician fee schedule. Final rule was issued and has been on display, although it will be later this month before it's actually published in the Federal Register. Two items we thought we'd flag, actually three items for you. The first is the physician value modifier. The Affordable Care Act requires the secretary to establish a payment modifier. And basically, it's a potential penalty if you don't meet the requirements. And the first stage was that by January of 2012, the secretary had to establish the initial performance period. So they're going to look at calendar year 2013 performance, and they're going to use that to do any payment adjustments beginning in calendar year 2015. And the measures that they're looking at to use beginning in 2013 are based on the Physician Quality Reporting System and EHR Meaningful Use. So they are aligning these various programs to make it somewhat easier for providers to qualify, to avoid payment adjustments, et cetera. They're also adding some per capita cost measures for those measures you see on the screen. Second is telehealth. So CMS has added smoking cessation as a list of covered telehealth services, and perhaps more importantly, is they're relaxing the criteria for Category 2 services. Since they introduced the Category 1 and Category 2 process, they've not had a single Category 2 service added, so they're relaxing the criteria to the definition you see on the screen, and they hope that will enable some to clear the bar and be added to the list of services covered. A third that we added just recently, there have been a few questions lately, and it's regarding a 3-day or 1-day payment window rule. And what CMS did is that there has been a rule that within 3 calendar days prior to an inpatient admission and 1 day for certain non-IPPS hospitals, all diagnostic outpatient services were bundled into that in the hospital building on their Part A inpatient stay. They've added all clinically related outpatient services except for ambulances, and there's some dialysis-related services. Those now get bundled, and then there's been some question because of this being brought up in the rule. Some people have had questions about whether this applies to various entities. It does apply to any outpatient services provided by a critical access hospital if the hospital is wholly owned or wholly operated by an IPPS hospital. It's not applicable to any independent or simply affiliated critical access hospitals. It does apply to wholly owned or operated physician practices. It does not apply to RHCs or FQHCs, even wholly owned or operated RHCs. And that's primarily because the RHC and FQHC claims don't include HCPCS codes, so they can't tell what you're billing for anyway. Because this is a change and because there was a lot of clamor about it, they're delaying implementation until July 1st so that they can work out the details among themselves. We've, again, provided links to the final rules for the OPPS and the physician fee schedule. And then I wanted to raise an issue that has come up fairly recently that some folks are aware of but others are not so much, and that is that, as you know, rural health clinics and FQHCs can be an originating patient site for telehealth. So they can be the site where the patient comes in, and they can collect a $25 origination fee, but it's not a billable encounter for a rural health clinic or FQHC. However, clarification from CMS, because there has been some confusion, an RHC or FQHC cannot bill Medicare as a specialist site. This is especially relevant probably for mental health providers. So because it's not a face-to-face visit, it's not an RHC or FQHC billable encounter, but more specifically, the telehealth regulation limits who can provide telehealth services. And while a physician or a nurse practitioner or a PA or someone can, the RHC and the FQHC bill as a facility, and an RHC or an FQHC isn't listed in statute. So that's why they can't bill. Now, RHCs can have non-RHC hours, and they can do Medicare telehealth during non-RHC hours. This does not affect Medicaid because states get to set the rules for Medicaid telehealth. And now I'll turn it over to Nicole.
Do we have questions at the end?
I think we will.
Okay. Okay, so we're just going to operate under the assumption that we'll do questions of the entire slide deck at the end of just covering the final ACO rule that was just released. So on October 20th, CMS released the final Accountable Care Organizations rule, and the final was just published in the Federal Register on November 2nd. Between the proposed and the final, CMS processed more than 1,300 comments, and so they've made some significant changes to the rule from its proposed to final version. If you have any providers that contact you that are interested in participating, we highly suggest that they actually read through the rule and the other rules that were released concurrently, just to make sure that they note the changes that have occurred from the proposed to the final. To highlight some of those for you, there's a reminder slide in here just to give you guys an overview one more time of what the program is intended to do. The intent of the program is to promote accountability and improve coordination of fee-for-service items and services and encourage investment in infrastructure and redesign processes of care. Sorry, there's a plane. And to incent higher value care. ACOs will be provided incentives to reduce the cost of care that they provide to beneficiaries while maintaining or making better their quality performance measures over a period of time, a three-year agreement period. Again, the model was really focused on CMS's three-part aim of better care for individuals, better health for populations, and lower growth in expenditures. I gave you guys a list of the changes from the rule itself, and these are all the sections that have had substantial changes from proposed to final versions. I wanted to highlight four specific areas that were changed that probably have the most impact on rural populations. The first of those would be the greater flexibility to participate in the shared savings program overall. From the proposed to the final, FQHCs and RHCs were not originally allowed to operate independent ACOs. They had to be participants of a larger ACO. That has now changed. CMS added revenue center codes that are indicative of primary care services to their definition of primary care services, which previously only included HCPCS codes and prevented RHCs and FQHCs from operating independent ACOs. In addition to that, they have created additional options for participation as it relates to beneficiary assignment. So there's now a two-part process for assignment that will allow assignment based primarily on primary care physicians. And then beyond that, if there are not primary care services provided by a primary care physician within an ACO, assignment will be based on the plurality of primary care services that is provided by either a specialty care physician or a NP, PA, or CNS. So that has changed pretty substantially from the proposed rule. The next change that I wanted to highlight is that there are simpler and more streamlined quality standards. They reduce the number of quality measures from 65 to 33. In addition to that, they removed the condition of participation of sorts that 50% of physicians within the ACO be operating under meaningful use of electronic health records, and it is now a performance measure rather than this early requirement for participation. Finally, there is a change to the shared savings models overall. I think one of the biggest concerns for some rural providers wishing to participate was the requirement in the proposed rule that ACOs all bear risk by year three, even if they started in track one. That has been changed, and now there's an option to participate in a no downside risk track, and within that track, they are still allowed to share in the first dollar savings. There are additional changes, as you can see in that list, and if you guys have questions about them, of course, you can email us, and at the end of the presentation, I included the links to CMS's fact sheets in addition to the rules themselves. These are the other rules that I wanted everyone to be aware of that came out concurrently with the final ACO rules. They basically highlight the waivers from CMS and HHS OIG, and those actually are, because of the changes being so drastic, are now in an interim final rule with comment period. So those are open for comment if there's anyone still looking to comment in that area. IRS released its notice with regard to tax-exempt organizations interested in participating, and the FTC and DOJ also released their final statement of antitrust enforcement policy. That's another drastic change. It will no longer be a requirement for eligibility that ACOs have an antitrust review up front. They will be allowed to do so if they desire, and it is strongly recommended, but it is not a condition of participation anymore. Another initiative that I wanted to highlight for all of you that is, I think, very important for rural providers to be made aware of was the release of the advanced payment model from CMMI, the Center for Innovation. This model was actually released following the proposed, but it was put out for comment and details were not provided. Now it has come out in a final model, and it's designed to support physician-owned and rural ACOs with upfront infrastructure investments. So this model will actually provide capital funding upfront for smaller ACOs that would not be able to advance that on their own. And CMS will then recoup those payments as the smaller ACOs achieve those savings. Up to 50 small ACOs will be able to qualify. And it's up to $170 million in advance payments that will be going out. Eligibility is restricted to physician-owned and rural ACOs. And there are some other eligibility requirements that are listed within those limitations that are available at the link that's listed at the end of the slide presentation. And there are those links for you guys, and any questions that you have, please feel free to email or ask now. And thank you.
Does anyone have any questions? Star pound to unmute your line. Okay, well, thank you so much for presenting and sharing these slides with us. We really appreciate you including the links to all the information in there, too. That's helpful for us for following up and trying to figure out some of these things later on.
Great.
I think then at this time we'll move on to the update from the Flex Monitoring team. I believe that John Gale is on the line to provide us with an update. And, John, it's star pound to unmute your line.
Yes, hi, yes, John Gale. I will be brief. We are firmly underway with some of our new projects for the year, so I'll just give you an update of the new projects. We've got a number of new projects, each conducted by the three universities, looking at the evidence-based medications, safety strategies and measures for CAHs, the effect of HIT on critical access hospital efficiency. There'll be a study done by UNC on the development of outpatient indicators for the CAH financial indicators report. We are going to be using the Form 990s submitted by nonprofit CAHs to understand the community benefit and safety net activities of CAHs and other hospitals. We're doing a policy brief on transfer protocols to improve transitions of care from nursing facilities to CAHs, and then also looking at an evaluation and an assessment of the impact of state flex program initiatives on EMS. So we have a full slate of activity. Certainly UN, Minnesota, ourselves, and the University of North Carolina are all going to be very active in the coming year. We have a couple of new policy briefing papers and policy briefs that have been added to the website. Most recently is a briefing paper on the role of the Flex program in developing and supporting STEMI systems of care for ST elevation myocardial infarction. We'll have a policy brief up, and we have two more that we're working on falls prevention as a policy brief and interventions that can be used by hospitals, CAHs, as well as a brief on the patient safety culture. There'll be other policy briefs and papers coming out of UNC and Minnesota shortly. So that's a quick update. I don't know if there are any questions.
Any questions at all for John about any other projects that are planned for this year? Okay, well, thank you, John, for providing the information, and I think that we'll all have to check the website and look at the new policy briefs that are up there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, I think then at this time we'll move into our presentations for today. I'll introduce both speakers now, and we can move then into the presentations and comments and questions. Our first presenter is Brooke Pelkey. And Brooke is going to provide us with an ICD-10 overview. Brooke is an assistant professor within the Health Informatics and Information Management Department at the College of St. Scholastica. Her content focus is on clinical quality management and clinical classification systems. She's responsible for successfully transitioning the college's course curriculum to ICD-10 and has successfully completed the AHIMA Academy for ICD-10 as an ICD-10 CM and PCS trainer certificate holder. And after Brooke's presentation, David Ginsberg is going to provide some comments on version 5010 updates. David's the co-founder and president of Private Plan Associates Incorporated. He has more than 25 years of experience in the healthcare industry. His prior experience includes serving as a co-founder and executive director of the Colorado Physician Network, which was a statewide network of 2,500 physicians that provided a physician-managed collaborative with a regional HMO. David was also the vice president of Intellectron Medco Bill, which was a large regional physician practice management and billing company providing services to over 1,000 physicians in California. And during that time, he implemented the second Medicare electronic claims transmission program of its kind. David has expertise in many areas, including managed care operations and physician hospital strategic planning. Additionally, he's maintained an active practice in compliance audits and consulting, as well as electronic medical and health record selection, readiness assessments, and implementation. David is a designated HIPAA and electronic health records consultant to the Colorado Rural Health Center and is widely considered an expert in the area of electronic health records and rural health delivery. David is also a member of our Task Advisory Key Informant Group, which is a group of consultants and technical experts in various fields that provide tasks with feedback and information and help us solve some of our technical assistance questions too. And we're very proud to have David as part of that group. So we have, I think, some great presentations today, and I think with that, I'll turn it over to Brooke to begin her presentation. And just a reminder, Brooke, it's star pound to unmute your line.
That's better. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be part of the communications today, and I'm going to start out talking about the implications for the International Classifications of Disease version 10, clinical modification and procedure classification system. So when we think about preparations for ICD-10, we really have to consider the first deadline of getting people on board and being able to successfully do the transactions with VRSA, with the updated VRSA HIPAA 5010. And we have to think about this as the first deadline of the ICD-10 adoption process, and it's definitely a very big project awareness item. So to process ICD-10 claims, providers, payers, and vendors must first implement version 5010. And so the reason they're doing this is because the existing HIPAA version transaction standards don't support the use of the ICD-10 codes. So everyone covered by HIPAA must install version 5010 in their practice management and billing systems and test them internally and externally and have them functioning effectively by January 1st of 2012. So it's really important to know also that although 5010 transactions will be in use before the ICD-10 implementation timeline of October 1st of 2013, covered entities are not to use ICD-10 codes in production prior to that date. But in both of these, there's a theme and a trend that's coming out as far as being able to have the functionality to test. So as you can see, CMS, you can kind of get a feel if where an organization is at. CMS designated the week of August 21st through August 26th as the National 5010 Testing Week for trading partners to test the compliance efforts. So if at this point, if you're not testing, you're far behind. So organizations must coordinate the version 5010 and ICD-10 implementations to identify the affected transactions. For more information, the CMS website has a lot of very helpful information on how to get organizations to the point of being able to successfully test for the version HIPAA 5010. The reason why that the planning and the testing is needed is because you have to have the validation changes, and it's the responsibility of the covered entities. So if something isn't programmed or interfaced correctly, it really could mean revenue and cash flow reduction. So moving on to the countdown to ICD-10. So today we know is November 9th, and the deadline for ICD-10 is October 1st, 2013. That means there is 691 days left. And you really want to think about how you're utilizing that time until the full transition is made. So in order to do that, really the best advice I could give healthcare organizations is not to try to develop something on their own. There are so many vetted best practice models from organizations like the Work Group for Electronic Data Interchange, CMS, and one thing that I know has been recommended is that a comprehensive model is now available for ICD-10 CMPCS checklist from the American Health Information Management Association, AHIMA. So in AHIMA's perspective, The model outlines some specific key steps. There's 30 of them, and of this total, 19 of them should have been completed at this point. So you can also see where organizations should be at and where they're compared to where they really are at. Some other important resources. In a statement to the Department of Health and Human Services in June of this year, the Work Group for Electronic Data Exchange noted that a survey result indicated that many vendors weren't planning to even deliver products until 2012 or 2013. This really limits the amount of time that entities have to install and test their products internally and externally. So if your vendors are not ready, you can't do your testing, and at that point your organization is at risk. Another resource I wanted to point out is ICD-10 Monitor. It's published by RAC Monitor, and it provides a lot of resources, in fact, weekly resources on updates and publications. So great resource for tools as well in their bookstore. And then, of course, CMS. And this is one of the most recent and critical guides that has come out for your organizations to review. It's also available on the TASC website, but it can be found on CMS ICD-10 website as well. And what it is, it's a published guide to help healthcare providers transition from ICD-9 to ICD-10. And they have specific levels. So the one that I put on here is the implementation guide for specifically for small hospitals. So at this point, preparation for ICD-10 should be well underway. Most providers should have completed all of the phase one tasks outlined in the organization's impact assessment and working on phase two tasks outlined in the overall implementation from AHIMA's ICD-10 preparation checklist. So as suggested by AHIMA, preparation and implementation planning for ICD-10 should be accomplished as a phased approach. You can see the phases in correlation to the years. And as a corresponding document to their timeline, they have a published checklist. So like for under phase one, they have all the different elements of an impact assessment that should be completed. And then for phase two, they list out many steps and provide different tools for the implementation, preparation, et cetera. So make sure that you know where the resources are and are able to help the organization attain those resources instead of trying to reinvent the wheel. We're looking at preparation, assessing the training needs and giving the appropriate training at the right time to the right individual is what's really going to be key. So careful consideration really needs to be looked at, evaluating the pros and cons for your organization to train early. This helps spreading out the training rather than a focused training later in the transition period. Allowing the spread out over many months has less impact on the organization's productivity and allows the staff more time to internalize and learn some more significant retaining efforts. So don't procrastinate. I know a lot of organizations, when I go to the different conferences, have not started or still on their impact assessment, really are far behind and really need to start looking at the time that they have left and use it very wisely. So again, here's an example of how AHIMA, if you were to go to their website, they have role-based training models. And what they're looking at this is they look at it as like a leveling within a healthcare organization and focused training for coders, a different set of level of training for healthcare providers and for billers, et cetera. So when we're looking at the challenges for specifically for the coding managers, the final rule identifies the need for 50 hours of training to learn CMS and PCS. This really presents a challenge for coding professionals on how you're going to get all these professionals to acquire 50 hours of intense training while balancing a current workload. So there'll be different training plans for coders you really want to think out the different roles and the different points between now and the implementation date. You want to keep in mind as well that 16 hours of training presumes that the coding professional already possesses the required knowledge needed to correctly apply codes using ICD-10-CM. So you want to use this lead time frame to assess coder strengths and weaknesses, particularly in the biomedical sciences. So we're talking anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology, pharmacology, medical terminology. So really look at in-depth weaknesses identified for each coder, and keep in mind that it's required for retraining the biomedical sciences are in addition to the 16 hours of the core training. Then you want to make sure to identify really which coders need to learn both CM, PCS, or who needs just the CM and who needs just the PCS. And then you can expand that training later, but just making sure the right people at the right time are trained for the right things. You want to make sure that all coders are aware of the change and provide opportunities to learn the structure and organizations and unique features. So we're going to look into that a little bit in just a moment, but a way to do this is to allow them to attend and listen to seminars, webinars, and review publications, because this is going to give them that general knowledge. And suggestions for reviewing A&P knowledge might be to have them take an assessment or to use, I know several AAPC, AHIMA, several organizations have assessments created. And you can also tap into your local colleges. So provide opportunities for them to learn biomedicals, learn the general equivalence mappings, that's the GEMS between ICD-9 and ICD-10, and provide training to coders on clinical documentation improvement strategies to increase the awareness of documentation that's required to accurately code in CM. Another good example is to use set up lunch and learns with clinical staff in your facility to help coders learn more about disease processes that are commonly reported conditions within your organization. And I've also heard of organizations that have coding staff involved in looking at a recorded procedure or even invited into an OR. So the second half of 2011 through 2012, you're beginning to review the code structure and coding conventions and learning the fundamentals of the coding systems, including the coding guidelines. And I'll go into that a little bit more, but that's the critical first step, is understanding the coding conventions and guidelines. Lots of ICD-10 newsletters, audio seminars, journal articles, et cetera. But in addition to that, continuing that increase in NatPhys knowledge and terminology. So looking specifically at ICD-10-CM, that's clinical modification, it is available free online. You have the full index, the full tabular listing. The index includes the corresponding tables, and it has the GEMS and also the guidelines. So once the staff have their general training, their general knowledge about the differences with I-9, I-10, it's really critical to get them in there, to get them looking at the differences. So here's just a reference to how you access that. And again, here is everything it includes, and it is the official draft code set. Okay. And just briefly, comparison between the differences in the characteristics of I-9 and I-10. Look at this. Some of the biggest differences is the specificity, because the process in CM ICD-9 to ICD-10-CM is very similar in the process to reach the correct code. However, the biggest difference is the specificity. I-10 specifically allows descriptions of comorbidities, manifestations, causations, complications, detailed anatomical locations. sequela, degree of function, phases, localization and lateralization, procedure, age plays a role in different specific joint involvement. So definitely different in composition, but the biggest difference is in specificity. So just looking at the coding formats, very quickly you can see the I9 and I10 up to the first five codes are very similar. And it starts out with the category and then the etiology. However, you can see that the additional code in I10 provides for much more specificity with etiology, and then an additional level of specificity with the seventh extension character. And here's it just a little bit more detailed. So that added seventh character is specific to obstetrics, injuries, and okay, and the seventh character, here's what it identifies within the categories of obstetrics, injury, and external causes. So it identifies where I-9 doesn't, whether or not it was the initial visit for care, subsequent, or sequela, whether complications from the initial care. And if a code is up to seven characters but does not fall with one of these categories, they have a placeholder code. In addition to the lunch and learns and assessments, really providing visuals from different types, for example, here, fractures, and continuing to, whatever training you're doing, always continue to introduce incorporating concepts of A&P throughout your training. I'd always also show, if we're showing a picture, also show the report or the X-ray that has abnormal findings that's incorporated in the same kind of scenario. So they get a whole visual of what is actually going on with this care. So PCS, again, just like CM, is provided for free by CMS. And here's the website. It provides the tables and the index. Really, really important to, again, have them get in and look at the differences. When I talked about I-9 CM and I-10 CM being very similar in process, it is a whole different story with ICD-10 PCS, with the inpatient procedural coding. So very, very critical, if you remember back to the training, the amount of training that's required. PCS has more training required because it is more extensive, and it's a larger difference from I-9. Very critical to look at the coding convention, like we looked at I-10, what's involved in an I-10 code, and then critical to introduce the guidelines first before getting into the detailed coding. So the medical surgery section is the most extensive section of ICD-10 PCS. So if you had a physical book and you could pull out section B, the medical med-surg section, it would be about 75% of all the codes contained within the code book. All right, and I have one guideline, and it's what I think is the most important guideline for PCS, is that many of the terms used to construct the PCS codes are defined within the system. It is the coder's responsibility to determine the documentation in the medical record equates to the correct PCS definition. The physician is not expected to use the term used in PCS code descriptions, okay, nor is the coder required to query the physician with if a correlation exists between the documentation and a defined PCS term. So an example I have here is when a physician documents partial resection, the coder can independently correlate partial resection to the root operation excision without querying the physician. So it's really important to understand when it is appropriate and when it is not appropriate to query a physician with I-10. With I-10 CM, it's that specificity. A coder can't code without the documentation of that level of specificity. With PCS, it's really the responsibility of the coder to identify the documentation and correlate it to the appropriate term that's been identified within PCS. So the one of the biggest differences with PCS is that once a coder, the index is very small, and once a coder gets really good at identifying the root operation, and we'll see what the root operation is in a second, they can jump directly to the coding tables and build a code from the coding tables and completely bypass the index. So you no longer have the index, and the index is very minimal. So a lot of times you go directly to the tables as well. So in looking specifically within the medical surgical section, here is a convention of the characters of a PCS code. They're required to have 7 characters. Specifically, the letters I and O aren't used because 0 and 1 are. And each individual character has a meaning. And each individual meaning changes by the section. Okay, we're looking at the medical surgical section. The section provides the first character value. The second character in a table is identified by the body system. The third character is characterized by what is called the root operation. So this is the key character when coding a ICD-10 PCS code. There are 31 operations. They're arranged by similar attributes. So examples are bypass, drainage, resection, inspection. And this is where a code table can change depending upon the root operation. Fourth character is the specific anatomical site versus in the general body system. The fifth character identifies the approach or the technique to reach the procedure. The sixth character is the device. And the seventh character is the qualifier. And characters 6 and 7 both provide additional information. A lot of times, character 6 or 7 won't have a specific code. Result is ZZ. Right, so kind of my spiel about the difference of the ICD-10 specific coding, but how do we get our providers engaged in improving clinical documentation? We really need to know that specificity because it affects documentation, reimbursement, quality measures, risk management, and patient history. So we want to make sure that we don't try to turn the clinicians into coders. Okay, we need to instead focus on the documentation of a clear and specific medical concept so that the coders can do their job accurately and efficiently. We don't want the clinicians to have to learn a new language. Coders need to interpret the new definitions based on the documentation supports that interpretation to ICD-10. So one of the best ways to do this is to get them at the table, so when we're together. So when we're looking at having sessions like lunch and learns, et cetera, on anatomy, physiology, it's also a way for them to engage in conversation. How are we going to be able to code this appropriately? Is there enough documentation here to code or to capture at the code at the level we need to for reimbursement? So engaging those conversations and having providers and coders at the table together. Really, finally, this is really an opportunity for organizations. It's really a time to seek out efficiencies and improvements, a potential to streamline old processes that we knew weren't working in the ICD-9 world, rework coding workflows, leverage use of secondary data, and just generally to clean house. The window to do this, though, is getting it's not going to be open forever, and the timeline just keeps closing. So we really have to utilize this time we have left. And the shared goal should really just be to perform better using I-10 than we did using I-9. right, I guess I'll open it up for any questions.
This is Tracy. Thanks, Brooke, for the information. I think that this is very enlightening about the level of detail that's required for the successful transformation to ICD-10. It sounds like an extremely time-intensive process that needs to be done right and requires a lot of training with a heavy responsibility that falls on the level of the coder. And I think that was one message that I took home was that the physicians are involved with all of this, but that really the responsibility is lying at that coder level. And then reliance upon management staff and the hospital awareness to make sure that the ICD-10 happens successfully and that they're provided with the training that they need to do this too.
You're absolutely right. The awareness to administration is going to be absolutely key because it is going to take time, and time is money, and they need to realize that if you don't start training now, it's going to be a whole lot of time taken out of one chunk of time the closer you get. So the more that you can spread it out, the better for purposes of taking them away from their current duties, and also because it's the longer you do it, the more that you're going to retain. So that you're right. The awareness is absolutely key.
I think at this point, actually, we'll open up to David to provide his presentation, then we'll open up the call for conversation and questions just to ensure that David can make the comments and remarks that he'd like to. And again, David, it's *pound to unmute your phone line.
Okay, hopefully I am being heard right now. And
absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize that we don't have any slides for you to look at. This was, I guess, a last minute addition. But the good news is I'm just coming off having done a webinar in 5010 for the California Medical Association. So this is all very fresh information. And I want to give a highlight, because there's not a lot of time left in the program, to 5010 and probably the key areas that I think are really important for the participants and listeners today. So segueing from the really excellent presentation on ICD-10, one of the key changes that 5010 brings is the capacity now in an electronic data interchange format, specifically on the electronic claim, the 837, and some of the other electronic claim formats, or rather formats such as the referral authorization, there'll be the ability to accommodate the ICD-10 code set, which, as you've just heard, is a longer field, if you will. That's one of the principal changes that promulgated the move from what we're currently using, which is 4010A, to 5010. But some of the very, very important components, and maybe just a real high-level overview, is 4010 and 5010 refer to a particular standard-setting organization called the Accredited Standards Committee, and their X12 committee. The way they say you must format and the codes that you must use to create a HIPAA-compliant transaction. So at the end of the day, we're talking about HIPAA standard transactions for electronic claims, remittance advices, eligibility and benefits request for verification and responses, referral authorization, claim status checks, and so forth. So these are mandated by HIPAA. They are required, and the 4010 indicator or the 5010 indicator simply refers to what is known as an implementation guide. The implementation guide is an extremely dense and thorough document of some 800 plus pages that describes every code set to be used in that particular transaction. It describes what we call the loop and segment structure, or in layman's terms, the data fields that are needed and where they should be put on the electronic format. And the very important component of all this is that we expect that 5010 is going to result in a whole slew of edits being put into place that heretofore had never been put into place by the insurance payers. And we are worried as an industry on the provider level, so I'm speaking from critical access hospital provider perspective, rural health clinic, et cetera, we're worried that the advent of 5010 is going to result in payers now beginning to implement edits that they've never implemented before. Some of the areas, just to give you a highlight, the change that are significant is there'll be new relationship codes to be used, so the way you define a particular patient to their relationship to the guarantor. You'll need to change the data in the header fields of your electronic claims. So if you use a PO box to receive payment, that must have a separate identifier, identification, if you will, the address, et cetera, from the service site, the physical address of the service site. They must be separate. You have to use a 9-digit zip code in your information about yourself, your facility. If you don't, it'll be grounds to have the claim sent back. You must use the lowest level denominator of NPI numbers. So group NPIs for your facility, organizational NPIs, as well as provider NPIs. And you must include the provider taxonomy on any claim where there is an individual line item that would have a provider, rendering provider. You must include their taxonomy. That is now a required field. That's just a little taste of things that are necessary with 5010. The problem that we are seeing, and it's somewhat rampant among critical access hospitals, is for those of you that are using older, I'll call them legacy, billing and finance systems that are maybe 10 years and older, if those systems are not capable of generating a 5010 compliant transaction, but instead rely upon one of the many clearinghouses out there to convert, then we want to prepare you for some very, very, very big problems ahead. And we've heard from more than one of these older vendors that they are not planning on changing to a 5010 compliant transaction because they simply cannot afford to do the programmatic changes. And we strongly encourage critical access hospitals who have that situation to be aware that they may find that there is data on a claim that can simply not be converted by a clearinghouse. And what most of these systems do is they generate a UB or a CMS 1500 in a we call print image, and then the clearinghouse converts it to the electronic format. But with the new 5010 format, the new edits, there will be data loss in translation. There will be data that can't be gained from the paper claim, which doesn't have spots for the data. And ICD-10 will probably be one of the best examples. And you are going to find claims that will be getting rejected, or you'll be finding claims that are not paid correctly. So this is probably the most important thing that we've determined, and I'm not at liberty to name names, but we know there's at least one major vendor out there of finance and billing systems in the CAW and RHC space that has just sort of flatly said, well, we're not converting. We're going to let our clearinghouse do the translation. For those of you that are in your journey to implement a complete EHR in the hospital or on the rural health clinic standpoint, it's a great time to consider, as many of you probably are, replacing your legacy practice management systems with the newer software vendors that are capable of generating these HIPAA standard transactions in their, what we call their native format, so that you don't have to worry about these particular kinds of problems going forward in terms of the data not being being properly mapped and paid for. So those are some of the key things that we're hearing in the field and seeing. It's incumbent, we believe, upon everyone to learn what the vendors, your particular vendor's plan is for implementing 5010, just like you'll be learning what their plan is for ICD-10, finding out if they'll provide you training. So, for example, you'll need to, there's a new code set and a new way to identify release of information on a claim. There's new code sets. Well, that means you'll have to figure out how do you map 5,000 patients or 500 patients' data that's sitting in your system on the registration screen that currently has the old code set. How do you get that now to be the new one? And hopefully the vendors thought that out for you. You'll want to be aware of new code sets. There are new claims adjustment reason codes that will be used. So you want to be sure that you're up to date on what they mean. So if you see a payer and a remittance advice that comes on with one of these new code sets, then you'll need to know how to map that and manage the workflow of managing that particular denial or the underpayment or the way they paid the particular claim. And then we think that it's also quite wise for everyone to be prepared that you may see a substantial delay in claims payment in the first quarter of 2012, and if you can, we encourage you to have some cash flow reserves. The reason for that is quite simple, and we saw the phenomena in 2003 when the first HIPAA transaction rule went into effect in the, under the current 4010A implementation program. And what occurred then was a great many vendors were not ready, and a great number of payers were not ready. And so the providers, in order to be sure they could get paid, started dropping claims to paper and sending those paper claims into the payers. Of course, what had happened even then is the payers had eliminated so many of their paper manual claims processors, their people, that they didn't have the staff to manage even a 10% increase in volume, and we think the volume increases could be much more like 20 or 30, even 50%, and there was this huge backlog. We think every one of the Medicare contractors is probably going to see that, unfortunately. We think they're going to see that in a lot of other areas. Apologize for that. We just think there's going to be a lot of claims issues going through there, so it may be wise for you to consider having some kind of cash flow reserve moving forward, at least in the first quarter. And it could be sporadic. It could be depending on contractor, depending on payer. If you happen to be in a particular area where there is a private payer that is more dominant than another, and you might have a lot of local employees that work there underneath that plan, then you may find some problems perhaps compared to some other critical access hospitals or clinics that maybe are more heavily Medicare, and perhaps the Medicare contract contractor is ready and you won't see any issues there. So I think that's probably a good little overview for the short period of time we have right now. Should we open it to questions, Nicole?
Thank you, David, so much. That's really important information. I think it's good for all of us to keep in mind that we need to keep in touch. The hospitals need to keep in touch with their clearinghouses and also to plan for a potential disruption in cash flow. Obviously, could have significant impact in some of our hospitals that have a pretty low operating margin anyways. We do have a few minutes left, so I think let's open it up to questions from the audience for either Brooke or David. And again, it's star pound to unmute your line.
David, this is John in Vermont. Can you just repeat which quarter you were talking about, which year you're expecting those claims payment lags?
John, I'd say first quarter.
Of which year?
I'm sorry, 2012 calendar year. Yeah.
Okay, right around the corner.
Yeah, because the effective date of 5010 is January 1st, 2012, so that's when we expect the rubber hits the road.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Brooke or David? Okay, well, I think that, I have one here. And just to note, too, that TAF did receive from many of the states reports on activities that you're doing or planning on doing within your state, either using flex funding or SHIP funding or other resources to address ICD-10 and 5010 issues. And so I think what we'll do, that information was sent out with a call, but we'll also continue the discussion within the Flex Program Forum to share ideas about what each other are doing. So look for posts to come in the forum about that. One question I have for both Brooke and David is, the Flex Program really focuses a lot on financial and operational improvement initiatives, and how do you feel that both the conversion to ICD-10 and the conversion to 5010 can be leveraged as a financial and operational improvement activity?
Brooke, do you want to take the first stab at that? You're the first speaker, and I'll take the second.
Sure. Well, I think maybe I think if I could just mention a couple of things. One before getting to that, I just wanted to identify productivity within the transition to ICD-10, but before we can get to growing financially, I really, really think that people aren't prepared for the reduction in productivity. I went to a presentation by Canada and Australia at the National American Health Information Management Association earlier this fall, and I was shocked to hear when Canada had mentioned that their productivity fell to 50%, or fell by 50%, and that lasted through the first entire year after following the transition, and that it took increments within that second year to start building that productivity level back up. And one of the other areas that they had not anticipated was how many additional temporary staff that were needed to help fill in with the backlog. And by the time that they had realized that they needed additional temporary staff, there wasn't enough temporary staff trained to fill those positions. So organizations financially really need to think about that, and that when they had actually hired those temporary staff, most of them became permanent staff, and then the first time that they were able to look at staffing levels again was about five years into the implementation. So huge impact, but the impact following that is that with the specificity of the codes, there was more accurate coding more often, and that less denials and claims. So to really, what are the differences? I think the biggest differences between Canada and the United States is that Canada had less time to prepare, still less time than we do now. So if we really look at accurate training and having the right resources financially, we might not get hit as hard as they did and see the benefits of ICD-10 prior in a shorter amount of time than other countries who have made the transition have. So just looking, making sure that you have that funding for training, the appropriate training, because it is going to make an impact on reimbursement following.
Thanks, Brooke. I might add that it is a really great opportunity for operational efficiencies. 5010 produces at least. And one classic example is, as Brooke said, you know, reducing denial rates by proper coding on the ICD-10 standpoint. Well, 5010, one of the key changes in 5010 is it allows you to have 12 diagnoses per claim up from the current 8. And at least on the provider-based clinics and the non-UB side, but thinking CMS 1500 side for technical stuff and for in-house docs where you may have E&M evaluative management coding, you now have the opportunity to more accurately indicate the comorbidities and chronic conditions that might cause a higher level of complexity. That's a classic coding but also billing change that will improve, hopefully, reimbursement, at least from the commercial payers. The other area that this promises is that we find that very few critical access hospitals really work a denial. And there is a whole new way to work denials based upon the claims adjustment reason codes. In fact, if you take a look at the various federally required codes that must be used, each one really comes and carries with it a particular workflow that might be relevant to use in order to move forward and implement perhaps maybe better eligibility verification. And I would encourage everyone to be sure your billing staff understand the claims adjustment reason codes and that you press them to have a denial management program moving forward. And you'll learn from that certain just basics, for example, how valid and important it is to do eligibility verification. And then if you follow with 5010, the verification now is going to become even easier because there'll be a much better standard to use for submitting a request, not just for eligibility, but a request for benefits, and you'll have a better idea of what that individual's financial responsibility might be and allow you to potentially pick up or get some of that payment at time of service rather than waiting till the billing has occurred and you're chasing the patient that much later. So there are some definite opportunities within 5010 to improve efficiency.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We're actually out of time now, and so I think in the idea of trying to remain prompt, we'll respect everyone's time and end the call. But I wanted to thank all of our speakers, Brooke and David, as well as our plethora of speakers today from OHP, as well as John from the Flex Monitoring Team for presenting. We appreciate your updates. We'd like to continue the discussion about ICD-10 and HIPAA version 5010 in the Flex Program Forum, so we'll look at, for information to be posted and questions to be posed in there. TAS will be sending out an evaluation link to evaluate this webinar, so look for that. And this call recording then, of course, will be placed on our website too, and I'm sure that this information could be very beneficial to the critical access hospitals and to the actual coders and their management staff. So with that, thank you everyone for joining us today, and we look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thank you for calling. We will return.